Greetings, everybody. This is John Lufter. Welcome to Lifetime Income. And today's Lifetime Income is an encore presentation of a program we heard earlier in the year.
The Financial Sense Lifetime Income Program. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Lefler.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of Lifetime Income.
And I'm John Lefler, and this is going to be one of the more important shows that we have done this year. If you listen to Lifetime Income, you know we talk about the retirement markets. We've talked about Social Security, Medicare, changes in that, long-term care. What you really have to grapple with is that everything regarding retirement is changing in subtle ways, which are impacting those of us who are retired or thinking of retiring, which there are a lot of people out there. And for all of you millennials, those who are just entering the workforce, because the paradigm that we've been using so far isn't going to work for you.
You know, the interesting thing about this, John, and we've seen this, especially in the economic realm, most of everything done in retirement today is based on models. You have software programs, you plug in a number, you know, I'm age 25, I want to retire at age 65, you know, what's my number? And there's a lot of assumptions that go into it. And the assumptions that go into it are mainly financial returns. And a lot of those financial returns are based on 50-year history, 100-year history, because if they took recent history, let's say if they went back to the beginning of this century, let's say in 2001, or just go back to the year 2000 when the market peaked, none of the numbers that are used in today's planning software would work. And we'll get to that and show you why that is. But, you know, when we talk about retirement planning, if you're out there and you're thinking, okay, I want to retire, I'm 10 years away from retirement, 5 years away from retirement, whatever it is, or maybe you're one of the millennials, you just got out of college and you're starting your working career, you're probably not even thinking about retirement at this point. But maybe if you're lucky, you are. And that's why I want to emphasize this, because this is going to impact you in various ways that you can't even begin to think about. And the problem is all of these models that we have built on how the economy works, how retirement should be, John, simply don't work anymore. I mean, the best example is probably the last 16 years. I mean, if you go back to the year 2000 and think of all the things that we've experienced in the last 16 years, the bursting of the tech bubble, 9/11, the second Gulf War, Katrina and Rita, the financial crisis of 2007 and 2009, the pig crisis, quantitative easing, negative interest rates, the war of terrorism, all of these events that are happening, 0% interest rates, negative interest rates, none of this stuff could have been modeled. And it's amazing when you take a look at how these models don't work, and yet we're still using them.
You know, it is amazing if you just look at the facts, Jim, because let's say, for example, we take last Friday's GDP numbers. The economists were calling for what? At one time, they were talking about 2.6% growth. The numbers most recently came back at 1.2, and they even had to go back and revise previous quarters. All of this averages out about 1%. So all of the previous assumptions, this is the most important thing you have to recognize, all of the previous assumptions aren't working. And there's a fundamental rule, if the horse is dead, remember to dismount. But what happens is a lot of people keep trying to ride a dead horse, you know?
Yeah, and it's not just the GDP numbers. I mean, we've seen the Fed reverse itself every single year. They've done it several times this year already. The IMF has done it. The World Bank has done it. Economists are doing it. Wall Street analysts are doing it. We've been doing that every single year since this economic recovery began in 2009. The point I'm trying to make here, if the Fed, if the IMF, if the World Bank, if the nation's top economists have been getting this wrong every single year, why would you believe the economic numbers that are going into your retirement plan? CalPERS, John, recently came out, and last year CalPERS had a return of 0.7%, and they're basically saying we're going to have to raise taxes in order to meet our investment goals, because their assumptions on providing these retirement benefits to government workers is a 7 to 8% return. they had 0.7%, not even close to 7% or 8%. This week, Rahm Emanuel, the mayor of Chicago, said he's got to raise taxes for the second time to meet pension obligations. I got news for you folks. The defined benefit pension plan that has existed in the corporate world went the way of the dodo bird. There's a few of them around. The same thing is going to happen to government pension plans. The private sector is simply not going to stand for onerous taxes to support a small minority that have these lavish pension plans. It's not going to work. And we'll talk about the way society is going to be changing going forward as a result of longevity is going to be totally transformational, not only in the economy, but also in your own retirement and investment markets. It's going to change dramatically when the government is no longer going to be able to meet its pension obligations, its Social Security obligations, its Medicare obligations. Everything is going to change just as it has in the corporate world over the last three decades. In the private sector, very seldom do you have a defined benefit pension plan where you're going to retire and get 70 to 80%. Basically, what you put away and saved in your Social Security, that's it. And unfortunately, there's another aspect to that too, and that's the investment markets. And the investment returns are not what they should be. They weren't there for last year for CalPERS. Last year was a terrible year in the market. This year is a little bit better. Who knows how it'll play out? But the big returns that people were counting on, whether it's fixed income in safe investments, we'll get to this later on in this segment, but those returns just aren't there. So this whole shift in the way you are planning your retirement, our whole industry, John, focuses on a number. We're all geared towards pensions and a number. This is the number that you need to have when you retire. That number is increasingly becoming irrelevant. It doesn't work. And I don't need to tell you, if you're in bonds, you're in money market funds, you're in safe investments, what has happened to those investment returns over this last, let's say, 16 years. And so this whole paradigm shift, it's gradual. And I can tell you, the day of the defined benefit pension plan is going to be increasingly going away. The next one to do away with it is going to be governments. State governments are already struggling with it. California, I made mention, they're going to have to raise taxes again to take care of it. Rahm Emanuel just said to keep the system solvent in Chicago, they're going to have to raise taxes 2 years in a row. You can only raise taxes so much before everybody says, you know what? I'm getting the heck out of here. I'm going to go to someplace else where they're not going to tax the bejeebers out of me to pay for somebody else's pension plan that I don't have. And so those are the real key things here, John. We live in a world that human beings love certainty. Why do you turn on the evening news, watch the weather forecast? You want to know what it's going to be like tomorrow. We like to feel that we know what tomorrow is going to be like. And it's the same thing in the financial world. There's gazillions of dollars that are spent on forecast every single year, from economists to Wall Street analysts and globally with financial institutions, trying to bring some certainty. What does the next year look like? And the same thing happens when we plan for retirement today. What is my retirement plan going to look like? And unfortunately, what is not being done is we're using these hypothetical numbers based on historical norms that are relevant over a 100-year period. Well, I can tell you longevity is increasing, but if you're 65, you're not going to live another 100 years, at least not at this point. So that's why a lot of these numbers, John, no longer make sense.
Maybe what we're saying here, Jim, is the number you're talking about is a moving target because everything else used to calculate it is moving now. And things are not established where they are. But if we talk about the key factors that are going to affect literally everybody now, either in retirement, moving into retirement, or long-term planning for it, I'm going to guess the first one's probably longevity, because as the generations move upward, we're developing new and better cures for things. There will be better cures for cancer and all of the other diseases with which people deal. And that means people will simply be living longer.
Yeah, I mean, you can see this with ex-presidents. We have Jimmy Carter and George W. Bush. They're in their 90s now. And Ronald Reagan, he was, I think, in his mid-80s when he died. I know at one time it was the longest living presidents we had seen in the history of this country. But we have two ex-presidents right now that are in their 90s. So what this all means, it boils down to two issues: longevity. And the second one is financial markets. Everything you know about retirement. And if you got a retirement plan, you better throw it out the window, because we're going to a new retirement paradigm that's going to change dramatically over the next 10, 15, 20 years. I didn't realize this until I read the book of our author, who's going to be on the Tuesday program, The 100-Year Life. We've been adding 2 years to life expectancy every decade in the last century. I mean, when they started Social Security, the lifespan for a male was 65. Today, it's closer to 85. So we've been adding 2 years to life expectancy every single decade. And if you take a look at how this plays out in most of our lives, you spend probably the first one-third of your life is spent on getting educated. You go to kindergarten, grade school, high school, college, master's degree. And, you know, I can remember, John, you know, when you and I were going to college, a bachelor's degree was it. Everybody had to have a bachelor's degree if you really wanted to move upward in our economic society. And then all of a sudden it became a master's. Now you have a lot of people that have two masters. They have PhDs. Everything is requiring a higher level of education. So figure the first third of your life was getting educated. The next third of your life was all about work, your career, whatever you did for a living. You went to work, at least in our parents' days, you know, our parents worked for one company most of their life. They had one job. For most of us boomers, we've probably had two or three. And if you're Gen Xer or millennial, you're probably going to have four or five. And as we discussed in past studies, the problem is, as a result of longevity, 43% of Americans cannot afford to retire. And the real risk is of living longer. And you basically today, if you are planning for retirement, you've got two choices: work longer or make do with a smaller pension. And those are some pretty tough decisions. A lot of people just don't have the stamina. They go, you know what? I'm tired of doing what I've done all my life. I've been doing this for 35, 40 years. I'm tired. You're going to see in a case study this week that we talked about where a doctor actually prolonged his retirement as a result of redoing and updating his financial plan. And we'll get to that later on. And how many people want to make do with a smaller pension? We talked a couple weeks ago. There was a series of studies, and one was done by the Wall Street Journal. Since 2008, the number of individuals in this country, age 65 and older, who are still working has risen from 15% of that population to 20%. And you're going to see that percentage increase more and more going forward. It's gone up by a third in just the last 7 or 8 years. It's probably going to go up by another third. And a lot of people are doing it in second careers. They're working part-time, and they're doing it to maintain their lifestyle. They're saying, well, you know, I want to maintain my lifestyle, but I just simply don't have the investment returns. I don't have the assets, and I don't want to give anything up. And the Wall Street Journal, in their article about individuals working longer in the workforce, they had four couples. One lady in New York, she said, you know what? I like working part-time. I get to go on my European vacations. I get to go to the theater. I have the money to go out to nice restaurants. So I'm able to maintain my lifestyle as a result of working longer.
You wonder about this from a couple of perspectives, because they found, say, for example, that individuals who keep on working partially while in retirement live much, much longer. That's another interesting thing. And remember, the whole focus used to be in our parents' generation, I'm going to retire and then I'm going to have the good life. And I think I could deal with about 4 days of the good life and go, I'm bored. You know, can I go back and do something right now? You know, that's just me. But also, your industry just seems to be really hyper-focused on the numbers. And these numbers are, remember, projections now of things that are anticipated to be heading our way. But even if we just go to the Federal Reserve's own numbers, they keep making projections for GDP growth, say, for example. Guess what? They're never right. And this is really spooky, because these people are making our monetary policy.
You know, it really is. Human beings by nature are creatures of habit, and we like to have certainty. That's why every night, every part of a newscast is going to give you the weather forecast. Even though the weather forecast changes so rapidly, It's just like, it's certainty. Okay, this is the economic forecast for the market this year. This is the forecast for the economy, and we try to plan around it. And of course, what we do is we adjust every quarter, as the Fed has done, as analysts will be doing in the month of September, as Q3 earnings come out, because they've been falling for five consecutive quarters. The economy has been slowing down for five consecutive quarters. But John, the problem with these numbers is these economic models, they don't work. They don't work in the economy, and they seldom work when you're thinking of retirement. The best example I'm going to give you is, had you retired in the year 2000, now think of you retiring January 1st, the year 2000. If you're listening to this, just think back of what was going on back then. People were making 15%, 20% a year. In 1999, the NASDAQ was up 70%. Heck, the first 3 months of 2000, the NASDAQ was up 20% in just 3 months. We were all going to get rich. We didn't have to save anymore. Think of everybody that looked at those models then. Little did they know it would take the S&P 13 years to exceed the high that was reached in March of the year 2000. We ran these numbers on our Bloomberg from December 31st, 1999 to April 30th, 2013. The S&P 500 was up 8.7%. Now, if you throw in dividends during those 13 years, it was up 39.6% for a rate of return of 2.5%. Now, 2.5% does not meet these numbers that you see thrown out in financial plans, like drawdown numbers, the 4% rule, the 5% rule. I've even seen higher numbers. If you take a look at the S&P 500 from December 31st, 99 to July 29th, 16, the S&P was up only 48%. Its total return per year was little over 4%. Here's the problem if you're retired. What happens is from 2000 to 2002, the S&P fell 45%. It went back up again the next 5 years. It peaked in September 2007. Went down for the next 2 years, lost another 45%. Interest rates in the year 2000 were 8%. As of this Monday, interest on 10-year treasuries are 1.5%. You won't find that in any of those retirement models. They're all based on these long-term numbers of 50 or 100 years. The problem is, folks, yes, you are going to live longer, but you're not going to live another 100 years if you're age 65. I don't know. There may be one or two of you that could do that. I don't know. We'll have a miracle. But that's not going to happen. Today, we have negative interest rates on over one-third of all sovereign debt in the marketplace. If you're in money market funds, you're making about 0.25%. If you're in five-year CDs, you're making a little over 1%. If you're in 10-year treasuries, you're at 1.5%. And even worse, 30-year bonds, I don't know what it's going to be like 30 years from now. You'd only make 2.25%. I mean, 16 years ago, did anybody see where we would be exactly today in the stock market with interest rates, negative rates, the anemic economic growth, the war on terrorism, all the things that we're experiencing today, $150 oil, and then $25 oil, then doubling in 3 months, then dropping down again? I mean, none of this stuff makes a lot of difference. These models don't work. We're living in a different world today. You're going to live longer. And that's why we'll get to some of the major ways you can make course corrections, because that's what you're going to need to do to make it through retirement. If you are retired today, you may have already been feeling this pinch, and especially if you've retired in the last 5 or 6 years.
You know, one of the conversations we've had a lot of times, though, Jim, and you'll hear other investment or retirement advisors say this, you want to be diversified, and the theory being that if you have various types of investment instruments, if one set goes down, the other set's going to go up, and that offsets it. So you have some kind of consistency there. So doesn't that account for these changes? Is that going to work?
You know, it doesn't. The issue that has come about with a world that is more interconnected today as a result of the internet and plus globalization that has taken place over the last half century, markets are all integrated today. So one of the things that we found in the bear market of 2000 to 2002, it was less so. I mean, you could have gone into bonds at that time. That's what we did. I mean, we hit out in foreign bonds because the dollar was going down. We were going in a bear market and the economy was going into a recession. That wasn't the same case when we got to 2007 and 2009. Interest rates, the Fed brought interest rates down to zero or a quarter of a point. And what we found in 2007 to 2009 is all asset classes went down. The only place you probably made money is if you had short-term government bonds and you had your money in cash. A good example, even more recent, was the first 6 weeks of 2016. When January, we opened up after the Fed raised interest rates in December, the markets fell every single week. All asset classes, commodities, gold, oil, hit new record lows. Emerging market debt, emerging markets, stock markets, global markets, everything fell in sync. And that's one of the things that happens when you have the internet today in a more interconnected world. So all asset classes fell at the same time. And that's one of the issues that we have to deal with. And imagine yourself, you're retired. In your financial plan, let's say you got your number and let's say it's $1 million and you're on a 4% drawdown rate, 5% drawdown rate, whatever it is. It's all based on this calculation. Each month you're selling off shares and you're pulling 4% of your account out. If your account isn't up, let's say the market isn't up, you're actually liquidating shares to meet your monthly distribution. Well, imagine if you are retired in the year 2000. And the market's down in 2000, it's down 20%. It's down 20% in 2001, and it goes down again in 2002, an additional percent. In the meantime, you're pulling out, while the market is going down, you're pulling out 4 or 5% of your principal in a falling market. And then all of a sudden, well, they say, well, you know, markets come back. The problem is you're liquidating shares. And by the time the market turns around, as it did in the summer of 2002, you have fewer shares to make a comeback with. Same thing happened in September of 2007 when the stock market peaked. It didn't bottom until March 9th of 2009. So another 45% drawdown. And in the meantime, you think you're going to be pulling 4 and 5% as you're watching your account drop 20% a year? It didn't matter if you were diversified. You lost money. And then what happens when you're losing money? You're liquidating your bond funds, you're liquidating shares of your stock ETF or mutual fund, and you're liquidating them at a lower level price, which means that when the market does finally bottom, you have far fewer shares. And that's why one of the big things that they have talked about, one of the worst things that you can experience, is to retire and face a bear market at the beginning of your retirement. It could destroy your retirement. And what we do know right now is, you know, you take a look at valuations. We ran this chart for a newsletter that we sent out to our clients recently. And if you take a look at market metrics of how stock markets are valued, and there's a number of ways that you can evaluate the market. You can look at the Crestmont PE. It's a geometric mean. You can look at the Q ratio. You can look at the S&P composite from regressions. And what we did is we took four valuation models. The highest valuation in stock market history, where it was 150% overvalued, was the year 2000, which was the internet bubble. The second highest valuation period was in September and October of 1929, when the market was at 88%. Currently, we've gone from an 87%. We are currently at 82%. Just about a couple of weeks ago, we were at 87%. So we're back to levels we were in 1929. We're at levels higher than where we were in 2007 when the market peaked. We're at higher levels than where we were with the big bear market in 1974. So we are at stretched valuations today. And what that means is when your valuation is this high, you run the risk of a lower return going forward, meaning you're more likely to face a bear market.
But as Luis Yamada reported last week on the program, Jim, if we look at it, stocks keep going up. We have a bull market going here right now, but they're not going to do that forever. How long can they do it?
Well, I mean, right now, you take a look at this run that we had after Brexit. Was the market going up because economic growth accelerated? No. As last Friday's GDP numbers showed, we came in about 40% of where we should have. Is it going up because of corporate earnings? No. This is the fifth consecutive quarter of declining corporate profits. It's global liquidity. Central banks are injecting liquidity into the markets, and people are searching for a home to park that money. Do you want to put your money in negative bonds, or would you want to put it in a stock where you might be able to get a 2, 3, or 4% dividend? The problem is, the longer this keeps going, the more elevated prices become, the more overvalued and overpriced the market becomes. And we know eventually that we're going to have reflation, we're going to have interest rates rise, and we're going to have another recession. I mean, just take a look at what's happened to the economic numbers. The economy peaked 5 quarters ago, and it's been in a steady decline. And the only thing keeping it elevated as it is right now is the consumer. Business investment is down. Residential investment is down. Exports are down. So the only thing keeping this economy alive right now is the American consumer. And we're heading, we know, towards another bear market and a recession. Contrary to what the experts or the politicians will tell you, governments haven't repealed the business cycle. So, you know, we could get another blow off, John, very much as we did, let's say, at the beginning of the year 2000, when the NASDAQ was up 70% in 1999, and it was up another 20% in the first 3 months of the year 2000 before it hit its peak and then lost 70% of its value over the next couple of years. So the point I'm trying to make here is, if you're basing your retirement strictly on getting a number in a financial return, you're going to have a rude awakening, as many investors did between 2007 and 2009, especially after experiencing the events of the bursting tech bubble between 2000 and 2002. And this is one of the reasons, John, we don't use these kind of models. They don't work. I mean, they work when everything is going up. It looks great. The models look good. You can look at historical numbers. They don't work when you're elevated as we are today in terms of valuations. And unlike previous bear markets, we're not sitting at 5, 6, and 7% interest rates. We're sitting at treasuries at 1.5%, and one-third of the global bond market is actually negative.
I want to remind everybody that Andrew Scott from the London School of Economics is Jim's guest on the program tomorrow right here on Lifetime Income. He has a new book out, The 100-Year Life, Living and Working in an Age of Longevity, which will continue the conversation we're having today. Now, if, Jim, we're headed into a new paradigm, as you say, there must be important signposts or markers, factors that we can watch that will guide us through this. If we're assuming there's a new paradigm, what are the markers of the paradigm that we need to work with?
The bigger issues, when you really think about longer lifespans, are family relationships, your mental health and happiness. Too much of the debate on longevity has been on finances and pension. That's where the government is right now. The only way the three-stage life is going to work going forward, if we're going to live to the age 100, and I'll get to some stats here very shortly, is for a very long, extended second stage of work. You know, you might want to think of two or three careers. Maybe you spend your main career, let's say, I don't know, you were, let's say, in the technical field, you're a computer programmer, a technician, whatever. You know, that's your main work. And then you were in that field, or maybe you were a marketing executive, or you were in the sales force. That's your main job. That's your maximizing career. Then you head into what I call your second phase of your working career, which might be semi-retired. It might be a different career where you actually work part-time. And the paradigm shift that we've had in our society is education, leaving school to work, was the first transition. The second transition was leaving work to retirement. There's going to be a third transition going forward, leaving your main job to your second career, be it doing something else, working part-time, being a consultant, starting a business, whatever it's going to be. And so instead of thinking of recreation, thinking of recreation, in other words, reinventing yourself, shifting your identity and taking on a new role and creating a different lifestyle in developing new skills. And this is the real key thing. As you mentioned, John, people that work longer live longer. Keeping your mind sharp and active. We're actually approaching a period in history, John, where we may see four generations living at the same time. Now, I want to just throw some stats at you. There was a study done in this book, The 100-Year Lifespan. Any person born today has a life expectancy or a 50% probability of reaching the age of 104. Now, think about that. If you're a parent and you just gave birth to a couple children, you're starting your family, or you're a young person today. If you're a young person today, you have a very high probability of living into your 90s. If you're a baby today, babies born today have a 50% life expectancy or chance of reaching age 104 in the U.S. Japan, it's 107. Canada, 104. France, 104. Germany, 102. Italy, 104. So basically 104 years of age. I mean, that is a really dramatic shift. And as I mentioned, we've been adding 2 years to longevity every single decade. I mean, look at yourself. I don't know how old you are listening to this program. Look at your family, maybe your parents or neighbors or friends or people that you know. Look at their age today. A lot of these people were not expected to be alive when they were born. As I mentioned, when Social Security was put into place in 1933, the life expectancy for a male was age 65. Here we are in 2016, the life expectancy is 85. And now we're talking about 95. So there's a greater probability of living longer. And that's why if you are planning for retirement today, I don't care if you're a boomer, Gen Xer, or a millennial, start thinking much differently, because that second stage of your life, first stage being education, second stage work, that needs to be extended. And within that second stage, you may have re-education, relearning a new skill after you leave the workforce and starting a new job part-time, a new career. So instead of a 30, 40-year work span, you know, you start work at 25, you retire at 65, you may have a 50 and 60-year lifespan, maybe 30 years to 40 years in a regular job, and a 10, 20-year period in your next phase of your life. But the only way that you're going to make it, and society has not adapted to this, pension funds haven't adapted to this, corporations haven't adapted to this, and especially government is not adapted to this. And this is why, John, this is all going to be forced, because as the Congressional Budget Office put out in their latest study, by the year 2025, 100% of government revenues will go to entitlements. There will be no money for defense, no money for interest on the debt, and the debt will probably double by then, if not more. We could be looking at $40 to $80 trillion of debt, because every president beginning this new millennium has doubled the national debt. So there's not going to be any room for all of these things. So there are changes that are coming.
Jim, if we assume that there's a whole new landscape coming here right now in terms of retirement, and we wanted to place an emphasis on avoiding the pitfalls, like I said before, when the horse is dead, remember to dismount. Don't look at the new paradigm with the rules of the old paradigm. But what would those points be to avoid as you move into this new paradigm?
Probably the biggest mistake, I would say, going forward, given the longevity, is retiring too early. It's one of the biggest mistakes people make in taking their Social Security at age 62 instead of waiting to full retirement age, or given this new lifespan, maybe taking it to age 70 and having it grow by 8% a year instead of taking it at age 66. The second biggest mistake is retiring at the beginning of a bear market. You do not want to do that, because you're going to be drawing down your assets at a time the market may be dropping 15 to 20%. And that's the third mistake associated with bear markets, are the big drawdowns, especially early on in your retirement years. It could devastate and wreak havoc with your retirement. So you really want to rethink, and we're going to illustrate that with a case study that will surprise, I think, a lot of people listening to this program.
And reminding everybody, Andrew Scott from the London School of Economics will be with us tomorrow on the program. His book, The 100-Year Life, Living and Working in an Age of Longevity. And since you brought up the case study, Jim, it's time for our weekly case study. As with all the case studies, they are based on real-life events from our own experience here. However, we change the names of the people involved to protect their privacy. And just a reminder as we go into this case study that the information contained in the material Jim and I discuss here is available online in slides that are at the very same location where you can find this audio at financialsense.com. And this enables you to follow along with Jim on the case study because it's quite difficult oftentimes to think about a lot of financial information when you don't have the figures directly in front of you. So that's what we're doing here. So let's do this. Let's see how this is different.
Okay. This is the case of Bob and Nancy Adams. And Bob and Nancy have been clients of ours going back to the early 80s. We're now working on the third generation of Adams. Bob's dad was my original client. Bob's dad referred me Bob. And then, of course, now I'm working with Bob and Nancy's children. But basically, Bob was a neurologist, and when we began his financial plan in 1984, he said, you know, when I retire, Jim, I want to have $1 million. Now, think of back in 1984 what $1 million meant. Back in 1984, and a lot of you are going to say, these are the good old days, I could have gotten 14% in a government Ginnie Mae. Government bonds, utility stocks, 14% was easy. And he was thinking in terms of his salary back then, I want to basically retire on my salary. So, you know, based on today's marketplace, I wanted $1 million. The problem is, when he retired or got to age 65, he would have more than that. But let's talk about where they are today. Bob is age 71. Nancy is age 73. Both are retired now. Their life expectancy, given their family history and their health, is age 90 for Bob, 92 for Nancy. Their risk tolerance at this point in their life is very, very conservative. It's income and preservation of capital. Now, when Bob was going to retire, he was really thinking, like many of you listening to this program, it was age 65 because he could get full Social Security benefits. But as Bob told me, he said, you know, there are a lot of things we like in our lifestyle. We like to travel. You know, they play golf. There are a lot of things they do. He has a hobby of photography. He has a lot of things that he does with his grandkids, not just traveling overseas, but he likes to travel and see his children. Just so happens that one of them lives overseas. So he wanted to enjoy the basic hard fruits of his life, but he didn't want to change his retirement lifestyle. He basically said, I want to maintain his lifestyle. And when he was thinking of retiring at age 65, instead of $1 million, he had $2 million. But you know what it was like 5 or 6 years ago? It was a different world back then. Interest rates came down to zero. And just think of how people, what were you feeling in 2007 and 2008 when you were seeing bankruptcies every single day, Lehman, Merrill Lynch, AIG, government bailout, the Fed printing $1 trillion worth of money, the government spending $1 trillion to re-stimulate the economy. Nancy, at the same time, was thinking the same. She was an office manager. She relied on her husband to make the financial decisions. Nancy wanted to know that the things that they enjoyed, if something either happened to Bob, they would be taken care of, and they wanted to have the same lifestyle.
Okay, but if we're looking at this as a case study, Jim, now that you've outlined that, I've got to assume that there are other factors here because, you know, you tell me he's retiring, he's got $2 million at age 65. Hey, this should be a cushy retirement. So obviously something else was in play here.
Well, I mean, there are a number of issues. Number one is they want to maintain their current lifestyle. Number two, they wanted to remain in their current home. Now, they had downsized from the big family home, but I mean, the house they had was still big enough because they always had kids coming in with their grandchildren visiting. So, I mean, the house was probably larger than most people would have in retirement. So they wanted to stay in their current home, and they'd set it up so that they would be able to handle it if one of them got sick or became incapacitated. They were worried about outliving their assets given the longevity of their parents and their good health. And another thing they wanted to do is they wanted to create a legacy for their children. Bob was fortunate that he went to medical school and his dad had put enough money aside to put him through medical school. So Bob was able to start out his married life with Nancy with no student loans. Now, imagine going to medical school. If you're a doctor, coming out of medical school, not having any debt. And so he wanted to create a legacy for his kids and his grandkids. When we took a look at their budget, and this is where it gets into lifestyle, his budget was $145,000. $75,000 of it was for essentials. $70,000 was for discretionary. This was hobbies. This was travel. This was gifts that they were giving to their grandchildren for their college education, because they wanted the same. Bob was very big on this, that, you know, his grandchildren, just like his children, graduated, because with his financial plan, we put aside money for weddings, we put aside money for bar mitzvahs, we put aside money for, you know, their education, because he didn't want his children to get out of college with a lot of debt. So less Social Security, the shortfall was about $100,000. That's why he really wasn't feeling comfortable. Now, his assets, his real estate, free and clear, $670,000. They had investments of about $500,000 in their trust. Bob's IRA was almost $1.2 million. Nancy's IRA was about $40,000. So their investments were about $1.7 million. Total assets of about $2.4 million. So he just didn't feel at age 65 that that was enough to live comfortably. So what he did is he retired from practice. He joined another practice that was looking for somebody to kind of relieve some of the pressure of doctors having to work and being on call on weekends. And so he worked part-time and made close to a little over $100,000 a year. Combined that with what he was receiving in Social Security, he was able to maintain his lifestyle. They took the big trips. They got the holidays. And by doing that, he allowed his assets to compound during a bull market without taking any drawdowns. He eventually retired at age 70. He's basically 71 now. His wife is 73. His residence is worth $780,000. His trust went from $500,000 to almost $800,000. And his two IRAs at $1.9 million. And his wife Nancy's IRA was $48,000. So where previously his assets, let's say his investment assets, were $1.7 million, now they were almost $2.8 million. So he had $1 million more to work with before he began his drawdowns. And so, John, here was an example, because, you know, at age 65, he reached his goal. He wanted a million. He had 2 million. But based on longevity, his health, where he saw his parents and Nancy's parents live, and like many people that were retired, they want to maintain their lifestyle. He wanted to remain in his present home. Even though he had downsized, you know, his house was close to 2,800 square feet, which is probably larger than most people that had two people. But, you know, his kids lived all over the place. And his kids, one of their favorite things to do is have the kids come out on holidays, to come out, bring the grandchildren. He wanted the rooms there. And he also wanted a second room for his hobby, but also several guest rooms so his kids could come out and the grandchildren could be brought with them. And also, furthermore, if one of them got sick later on in their life, the house was set up, wide hallways, bathrooms that could be changed for handicap if either of them got ill. So they wanted to maintain their lifestyle. And what we did is we updated their estate plan, but by working those extra years, he now had the assets, because one of his hobbies is expensive sport cars. And so that was something that he had. So where he is today, he's got close to $45,000 of Social Security. His investment income is $130,000. So less budget, you know, he has extra income. So he's semi-retired at age 65. He basically worked another 5 years, and that allowed his Social Security to increase by almost 8% a year. And it also gave him the extra money to have cash to pay for vacations, to pay for his sport cars. The mortgage was free and clear. His estate plan was updated. So here was a gentleman that basically chose to extend his years of work by another 5 years. And he just got lucky enough that those 5 years were the beginning of a bull market. So instead of drawing down the assets, he allowed those assets to accumulate because he never touched them until he had to.
You know what is amazing? You look at the private sector versus the public sector when we talk about retirement plans, because I have family members who are heavily invested in their pensions at work for schools or government type situations. And the corporations got rid of defined benefit pension plans because they recognized they simply couldn't afford it anymore. But governments haven't come to that realization. I mean, they're at the moment prepared to beat the bejeebers out of their taxpayer base to try to meet it. But you know, and I know that regardless of that, no matter who is in the White House, because let's face it, the president always gets blamed for everything, whether he has control over it, he or she has control over it or not. But no matter who's in the White House, they're going to have to do that because there simply will not be the money there to pay for it. And of course, that means a lot of political upheaval at the very same time because people are not going to be happy about it. But nevertheless, that's the rule. That's where we're headed.
And that's why, you know, I highly recommend that you listen to the interview of Andrew Scott, which will be playing tomorrow. And if you have a chance, a read, it's called The 100-Year Life, Living and Working in the Age of Longevity, because he's an economist from the London School of Economics, and he's looking at, what does this mean? People are living longer. What does this mean for society? What does it mean for corporations and government? It is going to be, folks, transformational. And that's why you got to be thinking transformational instead of recreation, thinking of recreation when it comes to your retirement plan. We're going to be talking and spending more time about this because I really think there's so many fallacies out there about retirement planning today. And especially now when we're about to, in the next year or so, head into the next recession and bear market, which could be devastating to a lot of portfolios. In the meantime, well, we've run out of time as usual. On behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on Lifetime Income. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant week.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSM. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense NewsHour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the NewsHour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.
Today's Lifetime Income program was an encore presentation of a previous Lifetime Income show heard earlier this year. Next week, we'll be back on our normal broadcast schedule.